8. Castration. But any bear that's been a captive for most of its life has no chance of coping with freedom. That's why we decided that we have to sterilize all our bears. Georgia, Stalin's Vestal Virgins. He comes to me at night. He gazes at me, puffs on his pipe, and twirls his mustache. He smiles and then heads for the door. Then I weep and cry for him to stay. But what guy would be bothered by a woman crying? Georgian men are like that. They have a drink, enter you, come quickly, and fall asleep. I hate men who drink. But here in Gori, there's no other kind. The other kind only exists in American movies. Stalin was a different matter, highly civilized. He knew how to take care of a woman, how to pay her a compliment, how to smell nice. He lived modestly, but he wore smart clothes, and he didn't drink too much. And if he did, it was only good foreign alcohol. I hardly need mention the fact that he conquered fascism and Hitler. So I said to myself many years ago, Tanya, why the hell should you have to squabble with drunks? Why the hell when you can live with Stalin? Anna Sreseli. He's like family. We're standing outside the house where Yosef Vissarionovich Stalin was born. His parents lived in poverty. His mother did laundry for the local priests. His father was a cobbler. As you can see, his house has had a structure in the classical style built around it, and the neighboring ones have been demolished. Yes, the entire district. No, I don't think there's anything odd about that. Would you be happier if there were hens crapping here and children playing ball? My grandmother lived in one of the houses that was demolished. She was given an apartment in a block. To the end of her life, she kept saying, "How happy I am to have been born next to Stalin's house, and that I can still see it from my windows." Grandmother could remember Stalin's mother. He lived here for more than a decade. She lived here almost to the end of her life. For us, it was a big source of pride, the biggest. Because in our town, there's nothing else going on. If it weren't for the museum, the town would have ceased to exist long ago. A few years ago, we had a war. The Ossetia border isn't far away. 100 Russian tanks drove into Gori. We fled to Tbilisi. I wasn't afraid they'd blow up my housing block and my apartment, only that they'd blow up the museum. But they didn't damage anything. They're still afraid of Stalin. They didn't touch the smallest patch of grass. They just took photos of each other by his statue. And that's how Stalin saved us from beyond the grave. When I was at school, some of the girls dreamed of working in a store. Others longed to fly into outer space. But I wanted to tell people about our great compatriot. I steered my entire life toward making it come true. I chose to study history. And after college, I ran straight to the museum to ask for a job. But by then, the Soviet Union had collapsed. The museum was closed and had barely survived. They had only recently begun to employ people again. I was the first person to be accepted in the new intake. Meanwhile, I'd started to teach history at the high school, so I work part-time at the museum. When I was at college, we were still taught that Stalin was an outstanding statesman. But the system changed, the curriculum changed, and now I have to teach that he was a tyrant and a criminal. I don't think that's true. The resettlements, they were necessary for people to live in peace. The killings? He wasn't responsible for them. It was Beria. The famine in Ukraine, that was a natural disaster. The Katyn massacre, I knew you'd ask. All the Poles ask about it. But there was a war on. In wartime, that sort of action is a normal thing. And before you start ranting, please let me finish. Are you feeling calmer now? All right. I'll tell you my personal opinion. I regard Stalin as a great man. But I can't say that, either to my students or to the tourists. So I say, some regard him as a dictator, others as a tyrant, and others see him as a genius. What he really was, you can decide for yourselves. Tatiana Marjanishvili. O Christ, take me to dear Stalin. When I see what they've done to our beloved Stalin, my heart bleeds. How could they? How could they make such a good man into a monster, a cannibal, an ogre? Once upon a time, bus after bus came to our museum. People stood in lines several hundred yards long. I used to look at those people's faces, and I could see the goodness emanating from them. But nowadays, one would bite the other. That's capitalism for you. Now I don't go there anymore. First, because of regret for my youth, my job, and my friends. And second, because my legs are weak. I can't even get down the stairs on my own. In March, I'll be 82. And you can't expect a person to be healthy all their life. In the morning, I get up, cut a slice of bread, make the tea, sit down, and say to myself, "Oh, Christ, why did you let me live to see times like these? Why do they badmouth our darling Stalin?" But later I think, just remember, Tanya, how much Stalin suffered for the people. It was for you, too, that he went without enough food and sleep. He fought against fascism so you could finish your education. And then I fetch the medal with Stalin's face on it, which I was given when I retired. I stroke the darling man's mustache, and somehow I feel better. I worked at the museum from 1975 as a nabliudatel, a person responsible for the order and safety of the exhibits. If anyone tried to touch them, we had to go and shout at them. It wasn't easy. Old women used to come from the villages and throw themselves at our Stalin. They had to kiss each picture in the display like icons in the church. And there are over 1,000 of those pictures. If a whole busload of those old crones drove in and they all wanted to kiss them, what was I to do? If the director was looking, I'd go up and shout. But if he wasn't, I'd say, "Kiss away, ladies. May God grant you good health. But don't touch the mask. Under no circumstances. The mask is the most sacred object in the entire museum because it's his death mask." Before, I worked at the National Museum in Tbilisi. But my second husband was from Gori, and I managed to arrange a transfer. It wasn't easy. The Stalin Museum wasn't the place you could just walk into off the street and ask, "You don't have a job opening, do you?" Public opinion counted. I was a divorcee. My first husband drank and beat me. The less said about him, the better. At the time, I was afraid the divorce would be a problem. Luckily, I had a very good reference from the museum in Tbilisi. The smartest people from all over the world used to come and admire Stalin's house. From all over Russia, Asia, and America, journalists, ambassadors, and artists. And I stood among the exhibits with a small card showing my name, as proud as could be. That job meant everything to me. The museum was like a home to me. My husband didn't understand. I had nothing to talk to him about. Although I only guarded the exhibits, I used to read books and got to know new people. But he drank, too. He tried to beat me, but this time I wasn't having it. Later on, he fell sick and went on welfare. He'd spend all day long sitting in the apartment or at his mother's. He used to say nasty things about Stalin just to spite me. When the USSR collapsed, he stuck out his tongue at me. It gave him great satisfaction. And then he died. It's a shame he didn't live to the present times. Now I'd be sticking out my tongue at him. What do we need all this capitalism for? All these American cheeses, juices, and chocolate? You can't even buy normal milk anymore. It has to be in a carton, because that's how it is in America. I think, "Oh, Christ, take me off to my dear Stalin. Take me away from this world, because I can't bear it here any longer." Nana Magavariani. Whenever I see him, a shiver goes down my spine. My job title used to be head of personnel. Nowadays, it's manager. The museum has a total of 63 employees. I am responsible for their recruitment and employment. There are 10 tour guides, 11 custodians, and 2 cashiers. Since last year, we also have a pioneer, a girl in a uniform and a red scarf who sells postcards and poses for pictures. That was my idea, for which I received a personal commendation from the director. "A tourist has to have something to be photographed with, sir. Otherwise, he won't praise our museum, and as a result, we'll have bad PR. I know, because we've had special training on tourist activity within capitalism. In the past, people used to come mainly from the Soviet Union. Russian was enough for us, but we also had two ladies who knew English and French. Nowadays, a Russian tourist is a rare occasion for celebration. If one turns up, half the personnel comes to look at him, and we give him the best possible tour. Let them see that politics is politics, but the Georgians are their friends. These days, most of the tourists are from America and Poland, and that's a problem because not all the ladies know English well enough to provide for that sort of tourist. Here, each tourist has a personal guide. What can we do? It's not as if I'm going to fire the ladies before their retirement or teach them English. They can see that in the new times they're not needed and that they're a sort of burden for the museum. But we never talk to one another about it. I know what it means to lose your job in your prime. I used to work at a clothing factory, in the personnel department too. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the factory collapsed with it, and everything was looted. Even the glass was stolen out of the window frames. In Stalin's day, something like that wouldn't have been possible. The culprits would have been punished. So these days, when I hear the stories they tell about him, I say, people, you've lost your minds. Remember the Soviet Union. Everyone had work. The children had a free education, from Tbilisi to Vladivostok. If it weren't for communism, I, for example, would still be living in the countryside. I would never have thought of occupying a managerial position because only men had those jobs before then. No system has ever given women as much. Since its collapse, everything is worse. In the past, the doctors couldn't refuse to help a poor person. Now the health service is private, and even if you break a leg, you have to pay. It's the same with education. A retired person used to have the phone for free and paid less for electricity. But now, you get a pension of $20, and the prices are like in the West. And life gets worse and worse for women. In the USSR, men had a good life. There were no wars. And if a man hit you, you could go and complain to the party committee. The committee informed the party cell at the factory, and the abuser could get into big trouble. These days, the men have no work, and they're frustrated. And when one of them hits you, you've no one to defend you. But at our museum, most of the staff are women. Even in the support services, which I haven't encountered at any other workplace of this kind. Most of the space here is dedicated to Stalin as a son, a husband, and a father. Less to him as a soldier or as a strategist. Women are much better suited to this. I also think Stalin's magic is at work here. Women were always mad about him. The wives of diplomats wrote in their diaries that he was very attractive. Something of his charm remains to this day. Sometimes when I stop at his death mask, I only have to glance at it, and it sends such a shiver down my spine that I have to go outside into the fresh air for a while. Larissa Gazashvili. I love his poetry. My parents were the Romeo and Juliet of the Stalin era. My paternal grandfather was a Georgian prince. He rode a white horse, he had a large estate, and in his house he kept a padlocked chest of gold. When communism came along, they called him a kulak. They took away his land and his gold and left him with nothing but a chest. I still have it to this day. My maternal grandfather was from a peasant family. Thanks to Stalin, he went to school. Thanks to Stalin, he worked on a collective farm. And later on, also thanks to Stalin, he became its manager. The worse life became for my paternal grandfather, the better it was for my maternal one. When my parents fell in love, neither of their fathers would hear of them getting married. My grandfather, the manager, shut my mother in the house under lock and key. Later on, he sent her to college in Moscow. He sought out suitors for her among the sons of his friends. My other grandfather, the prince, sought a wife for my father from the former aristocracy. Later on, he shouted at him, and even later he cursed him. But as we all know, when young people dig in their heels, there's no one more determined. My parents got married, with neither set of parents present at the wedding. They never went to visit each other and pretended not to know each other. So it was to the end of their lives. So when I got the job at the Stalin Museum, my grandfather, the manager, kissed me heartily, and my grandfather, the prince, was mortally offended. At the museum, I was responsible for propaganda. It was a very serious role. We used to publish a newspaper, Stalin's poetry, and other literature. He wrote beautiful poems, romantic, tugging at the heartstrings. If he hadn't become a politician, who knows, maybe he'd have won the Nobel Prize. The newspaper was called Bulletin, or rather at one time it was called Bulletin of the Yosef Vissarionovich Stalin Museum. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, it was reduced to Bulletin, to avoid hurting anyone's feelings. When the USSR collapsed, we had awful confusion. First, they closed our museum, then they opened it again. They changed the exhibition, then went back to the old one. Nobody had the money to replace the entire display, nor did anyone have the courage to close the museum down entirely. Too many Georgians still love Stalin. Now, unfortunately, there's no money to publish the bulletin, and I'm a tour guide. I went to college in Kaliningrad. I had a good life there. I worked at a school. But when Mommy fell seriously ill, I had to come back to Gori. Some people we knew said a woman at the Stalin Museum had gone on maternity leave, so I went to the party committee to ask about the job. They said first I had to pass an exam. The exam was hard. I had to quote by heart from the history of the Communist Party, Stalin's biography, and the history of the USSR. But I had studied history. I knew it all by heart, so I passed with flying colors. So many bad things are said about communism, but in the past, the director understood that on Sundays I had to have the day off because I'm a churchgoer. Yet now they've put me down for Sundays. Out of malice, I'm sure. Tatiana Gurgenidze. I'd have been good to him. I was born in a bad system, because I have the mentality of a socialist hero of labor. When something needs to be done for society, I go and do it. I've produced a wall newspaper for the employees and classes for single mothers bringing up children on their own. In the communist era, everyone would have respected me, but now that we have capitalism, they look at me as if I'm an idiot. So, when I really can't manage anymore, I come to the museum to calm down, and I say, "Mr. Stalin, I know you'd appreciate it." And it helps. And when I dream about Stalin, as I told you, he looks at me, twirls his mustache, and leaves. It's usually a few days after one of those relaxing museum visits. I'm not really in the right era when it comes to my attitude to men, either. You see, there wasn't any sex in the Soviet Union, at least not obviously. There was intercourse between the genders. There wasn't any of what the young people watch on television these days. All those music videos and naked butts, if you'll pardon the expression. Instead of a kiss, someone just lightly stroked someone else's arm, and that was enough. A woman had to be a good worker, dress and behave modestly. So, whenever I'm shocked by the sight of today's young girls, I go to the museum too, and I say, "Mr. Stalin, you wouldn't like it either." And once again, it helps. I don't like drunks or drug addicts. Our president upsets me, because why does he have to antagonize Russia? It's a known fact that you can even come to terms with a bear if you want to. But Saakashvili is insistent, with Russia just across the border, on making a second America here. We've had a war because of him, and we're sure to have another one, too. When the war was on, they closed the museum, so I came to the park, to the statue, and I said, "Mr. Stalin, you'd have got a firm grip on it all, and there'd be peace." And sometimes I go and say to him, "If you were alive, maybe we'd be together. You'd have a good time with me. I know how to cook, I'm a cheerful person, and I can sing well too." And I fantasize about how nice it would be to be Stalin's wife. But later on, I reject those thoughts because I'm behaving like an idiot. Stalin is dead. Communism has collapsed. It's over. It's finished. Been and gone. If I dream about him when I'm feeling like that, I'm very cold and official toward him in my dream. Natya Joldbori, son, be like Stalin. My mama told me, darling, don't go for that job. Of course Stalin was a great man, but something like that looks bad on your resume these days. One day you'll want a different job, and they won't give it to you. Besides, it's embarrassing to work there. But I have a small son, and I needed the money. In Gori, if you have any ambitions, there's no choice. You can teach at a school or work in the local administration, or at Stalinland. That's what some people call our museum. Young people especially like to make fun of it. They call the women who work here the Stalinettes or the Vestal Virgins, because it's as if they're doing their best not to let the flame of communism go out. I keep all that at arm's length, though I can see that for most people in Gori, the world ended when the USSR collapsed. I have one elderly colleague whose grandfathers were both killed in the Stalin era, but even so, she'll never stop defending him and loving him. I can hardly remember communism. I was born when it was in its decline. I remember seeing the tanks in Vilnius on TV. When we regained independence, my dad and I went to the main town square with a Georgian flag. Those are fine memories. Dad soon understood the new times. He sent me to learn English when I was just 7 years old. Thanks to my English, I got my job at the museum. There are only two of us here who can speak it. As a result, we have the most tour groups, while the ladies who are deeply in love with Stalin sit and make themselves cup after cup of coffee. Afterward, we get the same salary as them, but I'm not complaining. The main thing is that I have a job. My son doesn't know a single word of Russian. He's had English since preschool. It'll be a totally different generation. Stalin, a completely abstract concept. What do I think about Stalin? Here in Gori, it's customary for parents or grandparents to take their kids to the museum and tell them about him. I brought my toddler here, too, and I told him, just like it says in those American guides to success, he was much worse off than you are. His father drank, his cottage was falling down, and the other kids were good for nothings. But he was hardworking, thanks to which years later he ruled the entire country. If you study, you can achieve a lot, too. Anna Tkabladze, we boycott the carve-up of Poland. Here we have his favorite cigarettes. Here's the watch he was given by his mother. He was a good son, an affectionate husband, a loving father. He cared for his staff as if they were his own children. Nowadays they say he was a bad man, but in the archive we have pictures of him planting apple trees in the summer. I think a bad man would have been beating someone up or killing them, not planting trees. You have your views that he murdered millions, but there's no proof of that. All the documents were faked by Beria. Stalin only made one mistake. He was too good. He put too much trust in others. I can't say all that to the tourists. The management writes scripts for the guided tours. What's in them? Just like I said, he was a good son and an affectionate husband. We can also mention that he defeated fascism, but not much more. Murders? I've just about had enough of you. Here we have a sort of unwritten agreement that if a tourist really gets under our skin, we can go outside the museum to argue with him. But right now we are inside the museum, and I have to stick to the script. They've even posted a sign about the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact. Of course it was wrong from the start, because for Poland it certainly wasn't a good pact at all. But it gave the USSR a few years to arm itself, thanks to which fascism was defeated. But we're supposed to give the impression that the carve-up of Poland was a myth. So we leave that sign out of our tours. It's our silent boycott. I'll tell you frankly, I don't know what to think about the Poles. On the one hand, when we had the war with Russia here, you people helped us a lot. Trucks full of clothes and food kept arriving every day. But nobody harps on us as much as you people. Everyone else comes through here and listens with interest, but the Poles shout at me as if I were Stalin himself and had carved up Poland in person. And now they're saying Poland is going to help rebuild the Stalin Museum as the museum of the fight against communism. If that's true, all Gori will come to a standstill, because we have nothing here except for our Stalin. 9. Dancing Bears. When they see a human being, they stand up on their hind legs and start rocking from side to side, as if they were begging, as in the past, for bread, candy, a sip of beer, a caress, or to be free of pain. Pain that nobody has been inflicting on them for years. Greece, we'll sweep capitalism away. Because the government is cutting our salaries but not their own. Because the Germans have made Greece into a farm. They're earning billions here, but they won't stop criticizing us. Because we didn't invent democracy just to have someone make all the decisions behind our backs. Because capitalism is crap. We've started a landslide that's going to sweep it away. It's March 2010, and for a few weeks now, the center of Athens has been blockaded nonstop by demonstrators. Teachers, nurses, shipyard workers, engineers, and anarchists. Storekeepers shoulder to shoulder with gas pump attendants. Pencil pushers side by side with punks. Instead of tightening their belts, they've all come out onto the streets in jubilant mood, says Jacek, who runs an import-export firm in Greece. The ship known as Greece is sinking. The government is trying to save it. It has raised VAT and the price of gas, and has cut posts and bonuses in the state sector. But instead of cooperating, the Greeks are holding a general strike. And more millions of euros are going down the drain. Why is that, I ask? The southern temperament. In Ireland, people dutifully began to save, and they're getting back on the straight. But the Greeks, they're stubborn. When one of the factories canceled the workers' coffee break, it went bust. That's their character. Anyway, why are you talking to me? Go ask the Greeks. In Athens, there's a protest of some kind on every street corner. Monday, or the hoteliers who banged their heads against the sidewalk. Kostas, owner of a small hotel below the Acropolis, hardly sleeps at all these days. I've never watched the TV news before. Hell, but it sure sucks you in, he says, stirring sugar into his fourth coffee of the day. If anyone were to ban me from drinking coffee, I'd go on strike too. But they won't. Going back to the television, the thing that really grabs me is the yellow band at the bottom. Rail workers cancel. Inspectors continue. Doctors commence. Sailors suspend. Cancel and continue what, you say? How do you mean what? The strike, of course. It's the only thing the guests are asking about. And these days, every guest is worth his weight in gold stolen by the Germans. The Germans have been reproached about the stolen gold by Theodoros Pangalos, Greek deputy prime minister, because they've been criticizing the Greeks for their failure to manage their finances. Everyone's letting their emotions fly, says Kostas, nodding his head with understanding. We're sitting in the summer garden at his small hotel. The apricot trees have just begun to flower. One lady came here from Germany and said, "You people have a crisis because you're lazy and deceitful." I felt like telling her that if they hadn't robbed us during the Second World War, we'd be living like Germans now. But I kept my mouth shut. We can't offend the Germans. Too many of them keep coming here, and nobody knows what's going to happen a month ahead. The customers watch the TV news, too, and if there's nothing in it about Greece, then I get 20 phone calls a day and twice as many emails inquiring about bookings. But they just have to show some little hoodlums burning tires, and I only get 2 or 3 calls and 8 emails at most. What am I to do? How can I protest? Go outside the hotel and bang my head against the sidewalk? That's all I can think of. We're going to take a real licking over this crisis. 1 in 5 Greeks lives off tourists. If they don't come this year, in the fall, we'll all be packing our bags to leave. Tuesday, or bloggers versus drivers. In Syntagma Square, some happy homeless dogs are mooching around the orange trees. In the middle, there's an elegant fountain. On the corner, there's a McDonald's. On the far side, guardsmen with garters and pom-poms are guarding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Above it rises the Parliament building. "This is where they rob us," says Maria, a peroxide blonde approaching 40, who works for one of the foreign banks, puffing out her lower lip in disgust. That's why we're blocking this farce. During the general strike in early March, more than 100,000 people came past here. But the government said it would make deductions from state salaries in response to the strike. Nobody wants to lose their daily rate of pay, so the trade unions decided to organize small protests by sector. It's better like that, says Maria. I finish work, take a shower, and arrive here at exactly the moment when there's the biggest tailback. I work at a private bank, and there's no question of protesting. If my boss saw me at Syntagma Square, I'd be in big trouble. Others are in a similar situation, so we've been making our protest as Greek bloggers. What do you do at the bank? I advise clients who have more than 100,000 euros. What about you? If you had 100,000 euros today, what would you do? I'd get out of Greece. Various weird things are going to happen here. But for now, we're banding together on the internet and urging the government to tax the church and the shipbuilders. Did you know that most of the land in Greece belongs to the church, and that it doesn't pay a single euro for it? It's the same with the ship owners, in other words, the richest Greeks. And you're protesting against that? Yes. And against rising gasoline prices. From 1 euro per liter, a quarter of a gallon, it has jumped to 1.5. We're also protesting against the way the government keeps shifting the consequences of its bad political decisions onto the public. My salary won't be reduced, but more expensive gas will affect the price of every last piece of bread and sausage. The bloggers' protest has only attracted a few dozen people. Nevertheless, Maria is thrilled. Pretty good for grassroots initiative. Less thrilled are the drivers who are on their way home from work across Syntagma Square. Walk with us! Gas is too expensive! Shout the protesters. But the only answers they get from behind the steering wheels are insults. But Maria, Greece should be tightening its belt, I try to shout over the car horns. Typical propaganda, snaps Maria, puffing out her lower lip again. Have a talk with Melina. She tightened her belt 10 years ago. Melina is a little over 30. She teaches biology. Not at one, but at three schools. I work half-time at one high school, a quarter of the time at a second, and an eighth of the time at a third. Why don't I teach anywhere full-time? Because although I've been in the profession for 10 years, nobody has ever offered me a permanent job. Why not? Getting a permanent job within the Greek state sector is like winning the lottery. You get an annual bonus, and they can't fire you. But there are always more job seekers than jobs. So either you have to know someone well, or even better, pay up. As it is, although I've been working in the profession for 10 years, I've put almost nothing aside for my retirement. But for the European Union, it looks very nice, because employment isn't rising. Not enough nurses. Yorgos, a nurse at a large hospital on the outskirts of Athens, only started putting money aside for his retirement 2 years ago. After 12 years on the job, he stresses, because although there's a lack of almost 3,000 medical staff in Greece, nobody's bothered about it, and now the government is cutting even more posts and refusing to employ anyone. When our delegation went to see the Minister of Health, she refused to talk to us because she was busy receiving a delegation of hospital gardeners. But the experts are saying that too many people are employed in your state sector. Get your experts to come and see me on night duty. The emergency room is staffed by 2 doctors and me. And during the night, we might have an accident involving 2 people whose lives need to be saved instantly. A drug addict who's having visions and thinks he's Satan and whom I have to calm down. A heart attack victim. And several people with broken bones whom I dose up with painkillers because I know they're going to have to wait several hours. Meanwhile, half the beds in the ward are empty, and we can't make use of all the equipment. Why not? Because of the cuts. Quite often, the hospital commissions tests from private hospitals because then they can be accounted for in a way that looks better in the statistics prepared for the European Union. So what if it costs twice as much? Who's going to worry about that? The Germans are satisfied that we're saving money, and these days that's what matters most. Wednesday, or shipyard workers versus Germans.
We need to bring the Germans down a peg. That's what we're here for, says Yanis, who is blocking Omonoia Square.
Omonoia is at the heart of Athens. This is where the main streets and metro lines cross. From here, it's no distance to the Acropolis or to Syntagma Square.
But ever since the district was overrun by illegal immigrants, fewer and fewer indigenous Greeks dare to come here. By day, black men hang around the area, selling fake purses and watches, or standing in long lines for soup. By night, prostitutes from Nigeria noisily tout their wares. Here, the demonstration by shipyard workers from Piraeus looks a bit like something from another world.
Yanis is 55, and he works at the shipyard as an electrician.
Yes, he has heard of Lech Wałęsa. You bet he has.
He's a role model for us, for all Greeks fighting against dictatorship, except that he fought against a communist dictatorship, while we're fighting a capitalist one.
I wanted to say that these analogies aren't so obvious at all, but it was hard to interrupt Yanis, who was off on an anti-German diatribe.
They've made Greece into a colony, like in Africa. The whole European Union is a form of colonization. A year ago, there was a big scandal because it turned out Siemens was corrupting Greek officials, and that was how it was winning tenders. The Germans are teaching us how to change our economy, but they're the ones gaining the most from all the loopholes. We bought submarines from them for a vast amount of money.
And then what?
They've broken down. They spin to the left. We call them the drunken boats. The shipyard where I work has been bought by a German, too. They were supposed to develop production, so they bought it at a discount. But what do you think? They haven't developed production. And now they're selling us to the Arabs. At a profit. I can't bear to think what the Arabs will do to us. And our prime minister goes off to see Merkel and never says a word to her about the shipyards.
So the Germans are to blame for your problems?
And how? They brought the euro here so they could come on cheap holidays.
You've received a lot of help from the European Union.
Because once a German does come on holiday, he has to have everything like in Germany. They've built highways, they've restored the old sites, they've been trying to make it into a second Germany, but it won't succeed. Do you know what a German really is?
I think I know, but I decide not to answer.
The German is a robot. He gets up at 6, goes to work, and gets drunk on schedule once a week. And do you know what a Greek is? A Greek is good fun, friends, family. After work, I always meet up with my friends. We sit and chat. We visit each other. But the German, I've read about it in the papers, never enters his neighbor's house. If I wanted to be a German, I'd dye my hair blonde and start getting up at 6, but I don't want to. So why don't they finally get lost and leave our economy alone?
There has to be a receipt. German-style capitalism is already over for us. But the whole crisis started with it, says Lucas, an agency journalist. In the past, I'd get a call 5 times a day from some bank or other offering me a nice little loan or a nice line of credit. That's not normal. But now, they never ring at all. They know that people have been hit in the wallet. I work for a state news agency, so they've cut my salary by 25%. My wife works for a private newspaper, and they've cut hers too. Many employers are taking advantage of the situation to fire people or to lower their salaries. There's no question of taking a vacation this year. It's a pity because the kids have just gone off on their own, and we wanted to see Thailand. The government is trying to persuade us to get receipts or invoices for everything. It's estimated that the gray economy in our country may account for as much as 50% of the budget. Greece is known as a poor country of rich people. Receipts are all right, though at first the taxi drivers and doctors kicked up a bit of a fuss. I support all the changes. I see no alternative. But last week, the full-blooded Greek in me came out. Our front door lock broke, so my wife and I decided to invest in a good burglar-proof replacement. The locksmith came and said, "The lock will cost 100 euros, and if you want a guarantee for it, you'll have to accept the receipt. My labor will cost another 100, if you don't want a receipt. With the receipt, it will be 120.
Of course, I asked for him to do the work without a receipt,
just like at the repair shop, the dentists, and even the gas station. Lately, the government came up with the idea of giving tax inspectors the power to look into people's bags and ask them to show a receipt for any items they've bought. If they don't have one, they'll get a fine, and so will the storekeeper. I think that's going a bit too far. Like with the salary cuts. I can understand that for a few years we frittered our money away, and now we have to tighten our belts. But the cuts are too big. But we won't find out what the government is really up to until July. By then there'll be a 100-degree heat wave, and whatever they do, nobody will have the strength to protest. Thursday, or storekeepers versus the euro. How do things look from the storekeeper's point of view? I ask Yorgos Burbulis, also known as Jurek, the Polish version of his name. Burbulis was the assistant to Kazimierz Górski, Poland's former national soccer team coach, in the days when he successfully coached several of the Greek clubs. Now Jurek is the owner of three Polish stores. A can of Łomża beer costs 1 euro at Jurek's stores. Raspberry syrup is 2.35 euros. A can of army goulash is 3.40 euros, and half a pound of smoked ham is 7.20 euros. But when you Poles enter the eurozone, I'll wind up the business, because Poland is only competitive now. Even the Greeks buy Polish cooked meats from me because they're good, and they cost less than the Greek ones. Of course, everyone gets a receipt, without exception. All right, but how did a Greek come to run Polish stores? During the war in Greece, just as in Poland, the Home Army, with allegiance to the old pre-war government, and the People's Army, with allegiance to the future post-war communist government, fought against fascism. In Poland, the People's Army won. But in Greece, it was the Home Army. The ones who were on the communist side, like my father, for instance, were persecuted. My dad fled from Greece and ended up in Poland. That's where he met my mom, and that's where my brother and I were born. Jurek's family came back to Greece in 1974, as soon as the dictatorship of the colonels ended. We were one of the first families to return. My dad had never wanted to live anywhere else. He loved this country. I understood that many years later when I myself came home from emigration. I spent 20 years living in the United States. Here the air is good, the food is good, and the people are good. Paradise. Anyway, take a look at my customers. They arrived here 15 years ago, and they don't want to go home at all. His customers are Robert, Grzesiek, and Zdzic, all from Poland. They're drinking Łomża beer and praising Greece to the skies. Here, if you have a beer and then drive a car, the cops just smile. They have a human approach, says Robert. But in Poland, I've heard you can go to jail. So why go back there? Just don't write that we do nothing here but drink beer. If that were true, nobody would keep their job for long. We've been here for more than 10 years, and we're still getting work. What's it like? Now that Poland is in the European Union, it's really good. We can work legally, and nobody bothers us. Because before we joined, the police used to make raids on the building sites. If they caught you working illegally, you had to slip them some cash straight away. Otherwise, you were deported. And to get work legally, you had to slip them some cash, too. And to get their social security number. And to go see the doctor. So do you know why there's this crisis in Greece? Asks Jurek. Everyone wants too much for himself. I'm not feeling it personally yet, but I can already see that the customers have stopped buying ham in 3-ounce amounts. They've started buying it by the slice. Friday, or lefties versus the state. Exarchia is a district full of anarchists, communists, Trotskyites, alter-globalists, and environmentalists. It's hard to find a patch of wall here that's free of graffiti. At the local cafes, the politicized youth spend all day and night debating how to change the world. The police don't venture in here. At the very sight of them, stones start to fly. On weekends, officers with plastic shields are posted as a precaution at the main points in and out of Exarchia. Occasionally, everyone at the cafe tables suddenly starts to sneeze. Tear gas. Our guys must be chasing around with the pigs somewhere. The waiter then explains and fetches some moistened handkerchiefs. So I'm off to Exarchia with a knot in my stomach. I start at a cozy square outside the Polytechnic.
Exarchia? There are changes being initiated here that will reshape the whole of Greece, and if it all goes to plan, the whole world too,
enthuses Maria, an architecture student. One government has already fallen here, the Colonel's Junta. On November 17, 1973, the students at my Polytechnic declared a strike. The citizens of Athens soon joined in with them because they'd had enough of the dictatorship. The colonels got scared. They sent a tank to the college. 24 people were killed. But that was how the changes began, thanks to which a year later we had a democratically elected government instead of the colonels. The second time Exarchia rebelled was in 2009.
The smartest minds couldn't see it coming, says Maria. It began when the police shot a young guy called Alexandros, who mouthed off at them. The whole of Exarchia erupted. Soon after, the whole of Greece erupted, too. People fought with the police, and every day there were riots, tear gas, and demonstrations. Several police stations all over the country went up in flames.
They were the biggest riots since 1973. Christos is a teacher at the nearby high school. I have been working with the young people here for 15 years. I was sure something like this would happen. The kids spend hours studying hard. They finish school. Then they go to college. But if I ask my former students what their ambitions are, they say they want a job in the state sector. Is it normal for a 20-year-old to aspire to a job as a civil servant, earning 1,000 euros a month? But that's how it is in Greece, because we don't manufacture anything. You can either work for the state or in tourism. But what does that have to do with the riots, I ask? There's only work for the chosen few. You have to have contacts and pay a bribe, too. Then you have heaven on earth, bonus pay, and they can't throw you out. But for most students, there's no future in Greece. I ask Maria what it's like for young architects. There are two state-owned firms that take on the most talented or better-placed people, the ones who have a father or mother in the sector. Apart from that, there are a few private companies, but they rarely employ anyone. The choice? You graduate, and either you go abroad, or you find work that's below your abilities. At a gas station or an office. If you're lucky, you get a job in tourism. I'm in my third year, and today I'm off to do an internship at one of the agencies that brings in tourists from Israel. Maria takes me to the center of Exarchia. The once attractive little square stinks of urine.
Hash? Coke? Something harder?
Asks an immigrant from Africa as we enter the square.
Those who didn't say no are trailing about the place. Someone's smoking a joint. Someone else is helping a pal to shoot up.
Unfortunately, this place is getting more and more horrible, says Maria. The city quite knowingly lets people do drugs here. When the foreign journalists come along, what do they see? Smackheads, grass that's been pissed on, graffiti. But Exarchia is really about something totally different. It's about a refusal to accept capitalism, a rejection of the rat race. Here we're going to fight our way to victory.
But what exactly are you fighting against? The crisis? I asked. Maria waves a hand.
The crisis is chicken feed. There's been more than one of them before. We're going to fight against capitalism, to show people that they don't have to have a villa with a swimming pool and a helicopter to be happy.
So what do you want to change?
We want to do away with capitalism, and after that we'll see. You'll realize we're starting a landslide here that will engulf the entire world.
This concludes the reading of Dancing Bears, True Stories of People Nostalgic for Life Under Tyranny, by Witold Szabłowski, translated by Antonia Lloyd-Jones. Copyright 2014 by Witold Szabłowski. Copyright 2014 by Agora S.A. Translation copyright 2018 by Antonia Lloyd-Jones. This book was read by Stefan Rudnitsky and directed by Claire Bloom. This unabridged audiobook was recorded by arrangement with Penguin Books, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.